Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. European realist fiction and early French cinema, two conversations this week on Soundings. To begin, a discussion featuring Lillian First of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Following that, a conversation featuring Richard Abel of Drake University. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Lillian First worked on a study entitled Possible Places in European Realist Fiction.
A possible place in fiction is In realist fiction, it is pretending to be an actual, a real place.
Uh-huh. Are we talking, the word imagination enters in here?
I'd prefer to leave it out for
All
the
right.
time being.
All right.
Although I would argue that possible places appeal to a reader's imagination mm-hmm. through what is in the text. I'm trying to get away from a reading of realist fiction that is solely mimetic, that says this is an imitation mm-hmm. of a place. This is Dickens's London. Now, I'm not denying that it's Dickens's London and that you can approach it through social history mm-hmm. and that you can reconstruct, for instance, also the Chicago of Dreiser's Sister Carrie, mm-hmm. and that these are interesting and valid approaches. But what I am asking is, what happens to a student in North Carolina in 1989 who has not read up all the social history about Chicago in the 1890s and uh-huh. who reads Dreiser's Sister Carrie, or who reads Thomas Mann's Buddenbrooks, and who has perhaps never even heard of Lübeck and doesn't know where to put it on a map of Europe, or reads George Eliot's Middlemarch and isn't sure whether there really is a place in England called Middlemarch or there isn't. Now, these readers don't have a knowledge of history or geography. They don't need to look in all the footnotes. Because you don't read a novel by reading the footnotes, the edition.
Let's hope not.
You read it for fun.
Sure.
And yet, without having all that historical and geographic knowledge, mm-hmm. these readers derive a very strong sense of place. They will exclaim, did people really live like that?
Uh-huh.
Or, oh, this is so depressing. They will say this about the slums of Paris that are evoked in Zola's L'Assommoir. And so they have a very, very distinct sense of a possible place from reading the text.
You are talking about the creation of some alternatives, Lillian,
yes.
First. We do not have the actual geographical locations, nor do we have the place that exists solely in the writer's imagination. We have, what, a compromise, a combination of the two existing in the mind of the reader?
We have a combination of all sorts of things that are projected into the mind of the reader through the text. I often ask students, they shoot out interesting, provocative ideas, but then I have to ask them, what basis is there for this?
What's the evidence?
In the text?
Sure.
What's the evidence? Where do you get this from?
Uh-huh.
And sometimes they can find it, and it's something I haven't seen, because they bring a different angle, a different vision to it. But sometimes they have to retreat and admit that in fact is not a legitimate reading.
All
I
right.
think one can draw lines.
All right, now again, Lillian First, let's talk in terms of specific examples. You mentioned L'Assommoir, you mentioned Dickens, you mentioned Theodore Dreiser, you mentioned George Eliot and Middlemarch, an understanding of a possible place in this novel.
That's a really tricky one, but also a fun one. Because if you approach it biographically, then you might learn that George Eliot, Mary Ann Evans, grew up in the area of Coventry, and that Coventry was a possible model for Middlemarch. My point is that you don't have to know that it doesn't make any difference.
It can exist on its own terms.
Exactly. And even if you know that Coventry was perhaps a model for Middlemarch, where does that get you if you don't know much about Coventry? You'd have to go to an encyclopedia and look it up. And that's not the way in practice in which people read novels. Middlemarch is a long novel, 700 pages. And by the time you finished it, you know the place and you know the people. And the way in which you know it is through what is in the text, what is on the printed page. Readers often assume that places come to life in literature through a lot of description. And one of the surprising things about Middlemarch is that there is so little physical description.
It's what, more atmospheric?
It's more atmospheric. There are descriptions of houses, but you can get to be more specific than saying atmospheric. One of the elements that creates that place is the amount of gossip.
Huh.
See, in a novel, people are always talking to each other.
And it's a kind of a deflected description.
Exactly. People are scuttling around. People are meeting each other in houses, on the streets, on errands. They are talking. They are creating a consensus of opinion. This is how Middlemarch thinks. There are scenes also that seem digressive, of people talking in a bar, for instance, about plans to bring a railway through Middlemarch.
Mm-hmm.
And you see how people think. And what you learn is the mentality of the place. You don't learn so much about the geography. You learn somewhere on the horizon there's London, but you know that it's provincial. It's located in the northeast corner of Loamshire.
Uh-huh.
And that's a signal to the reader that it's a possible and not an actual place. There's no English county Loamshire. One of the intriguing things about my work on these novels is that I find that place has an ethical charge. It's not just a physical locality, but it is an ethos. It is a way of living one's life.
So you back away from the word determinism. You don't say that it is entirely, these characters are entirely without agency. You are suggesting, Lillian, first, that there is an element of influence in the atmosphere that these characters inhabit.
Yes, there's an interchange.
Uh-huh.
And for instance, what Middlemarch shows is that there is a limit to what you can do in a particular environment with a particular mentality.
Thomas Hardy did this very sort of thing when he wrote Jude the Obscure, the atmospheric influence on this young man of the university communities that he inhabited. How does what you are doing, which is to say looking for what you call possible places in realistic fiction, how does that translate into undergraduate teaching? Is all of this really just a little bit beyond most undergraduates?
No.
It is not.
No, nothing that one does, I think, should be written off as being beyond undergraduates. Undergraduates may not have a lot of technical literary knowledge. They may not know the jargon. They may not know the dates when things were published.
But you think they're pretty sophisticated.
Not sophisticated, but they have very bright minds. They have open minds. And you can show them and suggest to them and teach them things. And one of your functions, I think one of my functions as a teacher, is to share with them my excitement at what I'm doing with these texts, at what I'm seeing. I can try ideas out on them. I don't think that one should compartmentalize one's life into, this is my research, this is what I'm doing at the National Humanities Center this year. Next year, I'm going to go back into the classroom and deal with the kiddies.
Uh-huh.
I think that's a wrong way to look at it.
How does it work, Lillian, first, when a kid comes to you and says, I'm going to read this book in economic terms, I'm going to read it in sexual terms, I'm going to read it in personal terms? A kid wants to turn something that he or she reads, almost into an autobiographical discussion, and you simply don't see that. What do you do? Do you say, well, there's an F and that's the end of it?
No.
How does this work?
No, you have to lay down guidelines for students, and you have to tell them at the beginning of a semester what you think is okay in a paper and what isn't. And mm-hmm. for instance, an economic reading, a sexual reading, I would find those very interesting if they were documented out of the text.
Depends on the evidence.
Yes. An autobiographical reading falls into a different category. That would be fine in a creative writing class.
Uh-huh.
But that's not what I am doing. And I want, with undergraduates, I want to move them away from a reading of a text that basically is a reader response, a reader who says, gee, I feel just like this guy, therefore I like this book.
Uh-huh.
I want to discourage that. I want to say that is your life, that's what it may mean to you, but I would like you to see how this text works as a piece of literature. What are the devices, what makes it exciting, not only to read, but to reread,
mm-hmm.
and that it relates not just to your experience. And I may want to try and teach them that you can read books that don't relate to your experience with a great deal of pleasure.
Let's move toward a conclusion, Lillian, first. We're talking about your project here at the center, the finding of what you term possible places in realistic fiction. Will you reflect on one of these for me that is a favorite of yours? Why have you invested it with time and passion and scholarship? Tell me why it intrigues you. Name another example for me.
I've been doing a lot of work with Thomas Mann's Buddenbrooks.
Mm-hmm.
Thomas Mann is the first German writer whom I read at age 15, and I found him very difficult. But once I had got through that first novel and wrestled with it and got to some understanding of it, I knew that I was hooked on literature. And there is the pleasure of familiarity, of meeting again old friends, but combined with that, of new discoveries all the time. And there are these things then that one has found. And I taught Buddenbrooks last spring, and I know that when I teach it again, perhaps in 2 years, I will have new things to say because I have had the time here at the National Humanities Center to reread it, to think about it, to write about it. I have myself learnt, and I hope grown, and then I can share that with my students.
Lillian First teaches at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She's at work on a study of European realist fiction. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings continues now with a conversation about early French cinema. My guest is Richard Abel of Drake University. According to Richard Abel, one of the distinguishing characteristics of early French cinema is the transition from a cinema of spectacle or attraction to a cinema of narration. Here is Richard Abel.
In early films, the point of view shot was the attraction. I mean, somebody looking was the real interest in what was being looked at. And a good example of that would be Transparent Cards, a 1905 Pathé film in which a young boy is left alone in, I think it's his father's study, and he finds a book or a series of cards which have a woman starting to undress.
Oh, my goodness.
Those are not such unusual films in the early cinema. There are a lot of those. So that spectacle of the woman undressing for a man's gaze was the important thing. But there are other films at that time that use the point of view shot differently. For instance, there's one called Scenes at Every Floor, which has the concierge of an apartment building going up a series of floors,
mm-hmm.
And looking in the keyhole of each one of the apartments and seeing a different something else, something going on differently in each one of them. And that's a spectacle.
The inspiration for Rear Window here.
Right.
Is that?
Yes. Then he mimes that to the camera.
Uh-huh.
He gets up to the garret. The attic apartment, and discovers that there's a fire that's broken out in the room of a young man, and the young man comes bursting out. And the last half of the film turns into a kind of chase as everybody goes down the stairs. Everybody we've seen goes down the stairs, three different levels, and finally the firemen come in. Now, that's an intriguing film in that the point of view shots to begin with are all attractions. They're a form of spectacle. That's what we're interested in. And then the last one turns into a story.
I see. You make the transition.
It makes a transition. The first half of the film is one kind of cinema. Second half of the film is a different kind of cinema. There's some things within the industry itself and also within French society in terms of the legal definition of the cinema.
Goodness.
That probably provide a context for that.
Wait a minute. When you say legal definition, you're talking about what, municipal statutes and things like that?
Oh, yes, because the cinema in France was governed by, I think it's a law that goes back to the Revolution, French Revolution. Throughout the 19th century, there was a distinction between the theater, I mean, a kind of high art form, and what they called spectacle de curiosité.
And this was what, designed to protect some unions or labor elements or what?
Oh, no. It was there was a certain kind of freedom associated with the one versus the other, as far as I know. It was a kind of high art, low art distinction that was being set up. And one of the interesting things that happens in 1906 is that I think it's a financial law that's passed by the legislature, which cuts funding for the censors, which leads to a cutback in staff, which frees the theater from censorship. I mean, there have been all sorts of debate in the early 20th century over censoring the theater. But it was a particular law which freed the theater from censorship in 1906. But it did not free the cinema.
In other words, the
cinema was still defined as a spectacle de curiosité.
Mm-hmm.
And that came at a time when Pathé was reaching such a size as a company that it wanted to move out from the fête foraine, or the traveling street fair market, to a larger market, and particularly a kind of respectable bourgeois audience on a more permanent basis. And I think one of the arguments, one of the reasons for doing that was they wanted to really redefine the cinema as a theater rather than as a spectacle de curiosité.
And here we get into this question of narrative and storytelling. That what lends a kind of legitimacy to the movie.
Yes, and much of what Pathé does is not only secure and extend its economic base, but also to legitimize.
Were there people, Dick Abel, saying that the movies can, quote, do good in society? Was it that crude? How did these arguments pass back and forth?
Yes. For instance, a number of people associated with Pathé who gave a kind of prepared the ground for some of the things that Pathé does in 1906, 1907. One of his engineers was quoted. It's a quote that Pathé uses in their catalogs. It may go back as early as 1901. Engineer, his name was Dussard, said that the cinema is going to be the schoolhouse, the newspaper, and the theater of tomorrow.
Now,
which is exactly what it did.
And it reminds me of the same kind of talk that we heard about television and the rise of television in the United States.
Oh, right. Well, as I said, Pathé Frères was the dominant producer and distributor of films from about 1905 to 1911 or so. And one of the questions I want to try to answer, or at least address, is how that came to pass and what was it that led to their decline, so from 1911 on.
And in general terms, how do you account for that?
Well, let me mention the kind of strategies that Pathé Frères was involved in 1905, 6, 7, let's say. increasing their production and trying to legitimize themselves by turning the cinema into a theater, they embarked on a system of cinema building. They were the first company to build a whole set of permanent cinemas in France, beginning in late 1906.
So these are ancillary efforts apart from just the making of the movies.
Right. There are a whole series of strategies that they go through to both maintain and extend their economic base and to legitimize themselves. Mm-hmm. One is to build permanent cinemas within France from late 1906 on. Another is in the middle of 1907, whereas before films had been sold outright, either to agents or directly to exhibitors, Pathé decides to try to control distribution even more and goes to a rental system, so that films can only be rented for a particular week or whatever, sure. And then have to be returned or sent on to somebody else. And they set up a network of regional circuits to distribute their films within France, Switzerland, Brussels, etc. I think one of the problems, or there are a number of problems that Pathé faces, despite its dominance. I mean, if you look at the American cinema market let's say 1910, Pathé is contributing probably up to a third to a half of the films that are shown in the United States.
Goodness.
I mean, that's a sign of their dominance, uh-huh. at least in the number of films that are being shown. There are a number of problems. One is that French banking generally was much more conservative and cautious in its investment within firms. And that was not the case in the United States, so that Pathé kept running up against investment caution on the parts of his stockholders and partners, et cetera. Secondly, there were something like 10,000 cinemas within the United States by 1909, 1910, mm-hmm. and there were only a little over 1,000 in France.
So they had a market
to fill. So that there was a huge market within the United States.
Sure.
And Pathé very quickly realized that much of its profits was going to be depending on how it could control that American market. But the other thing that was important, I think, was that Eastman Kodak was the largest producer of film stock.
Hmm.
Something like 90% of film stock across the world was produced by Eastman Kodak. And Pathé, as part of its strategy of enlarging itself, decided to produce its own film stock, negative film stock. And it kind of went into competition with Eastman Kodak. Pathé, in a sense, was Eastman Kodak's largest client around 1910 or 11. Pathé decided to go its own. Eastman Kodak cut off all supplies of film stock to Pathé before the factory had been set in place. And what Pathé had to do to get film stock was to go back to its own, the negatives that it already produced over the last 12 years or so.
It's consuming itself.
Consuming itself. I mean, in a sense, sure. It devoured its own itself to sustain itself, destroyed much of its own negative to produce second negatives.
Uh-huh.
To be able to keep going before the factory could start producing. And it certainly allowed the company to survive within Europe and France.
But not the United States.
But not the United States. Uh-huh. So there are all sorts of things going on in this country which really impacted on Pathé, and it really lost out in the competition.
Let's move toward a conclusion here, Dick Abel. We're talking about your investigation into French cinema between 1906 and 1914. Why does this deserve a book?
Well, it's impossible to answer the question of why you write a book on anything, I think, ultimately. This is for a fairly special audience in terms of those interested in cinema studies. But I suppose more broadly for those interested in popular culture,
mm-hmm.
of French society of the turn of the century.
Does it, for example, have any analogies or echoes in what's going on in the entertainment industry as we know it in the 1980s? Are you looking at it solely on its own terms? Or are you, is there, the hidden agenda sort of thing here as you approach this topic?
There's not a hidden agenda in making connections to the 80s, I think.
Uh-huh.
I suppose, I'm not sure there are connections to the 80s so much as there are connections to the 50s. I think you mentioned in terms of television, the development of the television industry. I mean, somewhat of what I'm doing with the development of the French film industry, mm-hmm. And the kinds of films that are made at the turn of the century. It has parallels to the development of the television industry. And in terms of the American film industry, the way that that partly in response to television, but not exclusively in response to television, the way that the American film industry has broken down into a kind of cottage industry to some mm-hmm. extent mm-hmm. From the 60s on. Certainly, one thing that distinguishes the French cinema from the American cinema, even before World War I, is that the American cinema becomes very specialized and concentrated early on, so that a particular film is a responsibility of a director, a scriptwriter, and an editor, et cetera, et cetera. And all these are fairly departmentalized within a studio pretty quickly. And at least within the French cinema, there's a kind of director system, uh-huh. director unit system that's set up, but most of the filmmakers within France are also the script writers as well. So they're responsible for the script, for the direction, and usually the editing as well. So they certainly have a lot more control over, or seem to have yeah. more control over what's being produced than is the case in the United States.
Richard Abel teaches at Drake University. He's working on a study of early French cinema. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 460. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, discussions about medieval European theology and about the art of the Crusaders in the Holy Land. My guests will be Elizabeth Clark of Duke University and Yaroslav Folda of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. The last week in July marks an anniversary for the birth of the world's first documented test tube baby. Louise Brown was born in Oldham, England, during the last week in July 1978. The first airplane crossing of the English Channel occurred during the last week in July 1909. The armistice ending the Korean War was signed at Panmunjom during late July 1953. Finally, the Latin American liberator, Simón Bolívar, the American aviatrix, Amelia Earhart, the Irish playwright, George Bernard Shaw, and the French novelist, Alexandre Dumas, have birthdays during the last week in July. Simón Bolívar was born in 1783, Amelia Earhart in 1898, George Bernard Shaw in 1856, and Alexandre Dumas in 1802. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
European Images, this week on Soundings. Listen for Lillian First of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and Richard Abel of Drake University. Lillian First discusses her study of possible places in European realist fiction from Balzac to Thomas Mann. Richard Abel talks about his history of the French cinema between 1906 and 1914. European Images through Realist Fiction and Early French Cinema, this week on Soundings.